Surpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
So good evening. I feel like I've spent the weekend with a number of them. And I have. So I want to continue what I began talking about on Saturday. Talked about last night. What I've been talking about for these several days is body-mind awareness and body-mind training by implication. So this is a realm in which body and mind cannot be separated from each other. They can't be clearly differentiated from each other in our sense of it. We can't distinguish between our body and mind. So which are we training when we sit? Body? Mind? Obviously both. But if you try to divide them up, it becomes immediately apparent that we can't tell which is which. Does compassion come from body or mind? Does love come from body or mind? Is anger of the body or mind? So see what I mean? You can't separate them out. Only intellectually can you separate them out. So the four foundations of mindfulness, which I've mentioned every day, this is form or body. Body is entrance to the foundations of mindfulness. Then feelings, then thoughts or consciousness, then phenomena, the stuff we assign to out there. And last night I discussed the arbitrariness of where we draw the line, or close in or close out, and the situations under which you might decide where the line is. But wherever you draw the line, all the stuff you decide is out there is called phenomena. And to study that is one of the foundations of mindfulness. So the practice of these four foundations, particularly the body foundation, the entrance to the others, is as essential to the development of ourselves as compassionate and wise people as air and water. The practice of the four foundations of mindfulness is as essential as air and water. You can't challenge the overriding dominance of greed, hate, and delusion of gaining mind without developing the stability to focus on the details of the present that only a disciplined mind can manage. All meditation practice is to shift you out of appetite-based reality into breath-based reality, appearance-based reality rather than concept-based reality, to bring you to now. What is now but body sensations, sense impressions, thoughts, and the perception of stuff? So when our teachers tell us to be mindful, and every Buddhist teacher, no matter what school, advises us to be mindful, when we're practicing right concentration in our sitting and right mindfulness in our walking around meditation, that's what we're concentrating on. That's what we're being mindful of. Body sensations, sense impressions, thoughts streaming through, and phenomena. That's what we're being mindful of. That's what that means. Please be mindful. So there are countless timeless and boundless sensory experiences to be had, and we have them continually, all the time. But we tend to focus on our labels. We tend to want to understand things rather than just experience, have the raw, unmediated experience. So mindfulness on the details of now enable you to stop blocking immediate experience in favor of your thoughts and judgments. So when you allow yourself to experience the present, the floor doesn't stay a floor. People don't stay in their cubbyholes. That's the big reason we don't want to have immediate experiences. Things don't stay where they're supposed to stay. They tend to just get all mixed up. I was talking to someone today and I said it's like a sock drawer. We put the socks, we make them, put them together, put them in according to color and fabric or whatever. But in the dryer, they get all mixed up, and so that is breath-based reality when your socks get all mixed up. In the dryer, they don't stay where they're supposed to stay. And she said, that's sock dharma. So not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing what things are, understanding what they are, is most intimate. There's nothing between you and your experience. That's as intimate as you can get. The direct, raw perception of things. So, as I said last night, we want this. We yearn for this. Why, this is why we're all here, but we're scared to death of it. Because it's chaotic. All of our education has been to cultivate the sock drawer. The sock drawer is the emblem of our education and our organization of things. So we're afraid to let go of our minds and rely on what? You know, rely on what? Even though our teachers encourage us to practice nowhere standing, we resist such a terrifying idea, and we cling instead to the tenets of Buddhism, creating just another dead idea to hold on to. Just like the dead ones we so bravely gave up in order to start practice. We sustain a meditation practice to get comfortable with the chaos, to develop the stability, to get comfortable with the free fall that we actually live in if we're open to it. So meditation fosters the stability that enables us to bring forward in trust a reality that we already know somehow. We know this somehow, this reality, this chaos that I'm talking about. We know it through the wisdom of our bodies, but it's habitually overshadowed and overcome by our cravings and fears. So tonight I'd like to talk about the somehow, how we know this, this body wisdom. That unless we're aware of and trust, we cling again and again to our thoughts and concepts. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Zen poem, The Mind of Absolute Trust. When I was here a year ago, I spent the weekend talking about that. That's what I'm talking about again tonight. The Mind of Absolute Trust. The trust. How can you trust anything? It has to be an attitude of trust. You can't trust anything. It's just tumbling in space over and over and over. So So how can you come to be comfortable with that free fall? And even trust your own greed, hate, and delusion. You can trust greed, hate, and delusion. If your standards are very low, you can trust it. Just trust that it will be there always. So that's low standards for trust. But it is something. It is something. So this is the core of trusting oneself, and it's not self-acceptance exactly. It's much bigger. It's much vaster than that. It's not having a particular self at all, just raw experience. So from my point of view, as a counselor for people who have chronic pain that won't go away, or people who have experienced the catastrophe, the catastrophic circumstances that often accompany chronic pain, they've lost everything. Everything that was important was swept away by circumstances. This is how to survive this mind of absolute trust. Nothing else can be held onto anymore. There's no way to survive except nowhere standing. When we have nothing left to hold on to, we have to find comfort and support in the mundane details of our everyday lives. Except they're not particularly mundane when you start to pay attention to them. Last night I mentioned spoons. These things are not mundane when you invest them with your full attention. They become holy when you invest them with your full attention. It is attention that makes something holy and sacred. The way you touch it or handle it. The way you close the door of your microwave. The way you open the door of your car. This kind of attention makes mundane objects holy and comfort, and support is found in these objects when you treat them this way. So this is what we call suchness. You hear that word. Suchness means this particular appreciation of things as unique and appearing right here, right now, in a way they never will again. Suchness is how you see things when you see the emptiness of them, the impermanence of them. Then you appreciate that they are appearing right here, right now. When you look at the face of a person you've been married to for 20 or 30 years, and you look and you see someone who can die, who will die, perhaps before you, and you see how precious they are, that's suchness. That's that appreciation. That unique, shining uniqueness of things. When you don't have any particular attachment happening at that moment, then you understand that this is going to disappear. But it's here right now. It's here right now. So the world of suchness is a deeply healing realm, a deeply healing world. It's the upside down of the impermanence of the form world. You know, usually when we say impermanence, we say, oh, boo-hoo, it's going to go away. But suchness is the upside of impermanence. It's going to go away, but here it is. Here it is. So impermanence has these different aspects to it. So I want to tell you about a practitioner that I know, was a student of mine for some years, and he moved away, and we keep in touch. He's a practitioner who lost his ability to function in an accident while he was still a young man. Just after earning his master's degree in engineering, he had this terrible accident, so he never was able to practice his profession, to use his degree. He was never able to earn a living. So now he's almost middle-aged, and part of his daily routine is to strengthen his back muscles in a gym. His vertebra were greatly injured, and he never recovered the full use of his back. So he, you know, this is part of his life for many years now, is just to strengthen, to exercise, to ease pain. But he's always in pain. So he goes to a gym on a regular basis to strengthen his back muscles. He's just started being able to do this, by the way, since I've known him. For many years, all he did was lie down. His whole world was from the ground. I know somebody who can tell us a little bit about that. So he did this for years. His whole social life went on from the ground. Hi, glad to meet you. He went to all his children's parent teachers, you know, things. All, you know, was even part of a men's group. Hi, glad to meet you. So he even has prism glasses so that he can see things the way we see them while he's lying down. So he's now led about half his entire life on the floor. Anyway, he's currently able to go to a gym, and he walks around quite a bit. He even most recently has started skiing. He was an expert skier before. So for months at this gym, he's worked out alongside healthy, strong, able-bodied men in a macho atmosphere. I'm told that gyms are very macho atmospheres. So this man I'm talking about, this practitioner, would be quite macho himself were he able to carry that off in the gym. He loves that part of being a man. So it's been quite painful to him to be lesser than the other men at the gym, to be ignored or stared at or dismissed, not taken seriously as a full person at this gym. But the reality of the situation is that ever since he started going there, he has always focused on the differences between himself and the other men who are there. This is how he's looked at the situation. They are strong, he is weak. They're fully functioning, he is handicapped. They are fulfilling their potential as men, he is inadequate. But then one day, he slipped into another state of mind. What he and I started between us calling the flow mind, the mind of flow, breath-based reality, where things just flow, they don't stay where they're supposed to stay. This is reality based on breath rather than thought. And he suddenly saw himself and the other men as not different, not two, as we say in Zen. He was deeply nourished by this sudden disappearance of duality. And there was, at that time that he was in this state of mind, there was no health, no sickness, no strength, no weakness, just this. Just this. And it thrilled him to his bones. Then he went home to his wife and daughters. And he came into the usual tumultuous household with the two daughters fighting and his wife yelling at them. And they were doing activities. You know, every time he came home from the gym, they're always in the middle of some activity. His wife is getting, you know, dinner ready, and the kids are doing whatever they're doing. They're young kids. Oh, about 8 and 6, I think. So usually he tries to quiet them all whenever he comes home. Hey, I'm home. Be quiet. Because he's more comfortable with quiet. If you have a lot of pain, noise is overwhelming. But this particular day, he came home and he stood at the door and took all this tumult in. And he felt his way into their energy level and then entered his home. He entered at that energy level, just like a child enters a skipping rope. You wait till just the right, and then you move with the rope, and you're entered. Then you start skipping the rope. And again, he was deeply nourished and included. He suddenly became part of the tumult, not the separated out person who needs quiet. No high energy on their part, no low energy on his part. No exclusion, no chaos, no calm. Just this. So for me, this kind of experience is based on deeply trusting yourself. Deeply trusting some part of yourself, at least, because there's no longer any issue of inadequacy or competence or achievement. All of that's irrelevant. There's just this, entering the world just as it is, just as you are. Just as you are, with this body and mind. With all, here's the world with all its ornate detail. Here's you with all your, you know, your warts and neuroses. All that becomes just absolutely perfect. And much of this detail, and both your neuroses and the ornateness of the world, is deeply nourishing, just because it is. It's supportive and healing, as I said, as I've been saying all along. And because I have pain and very little physical energy myself, whenever I enter a room, I look for the support in the room, in the details. What's handmade in a room? That's supportive of me, because you can feel the vibes in a handmade thing. What was once alive in a room, like things made of wood, things, dried plants, whatever, handmade bowls, you know. There are many rooms, you know, that I've been to this weekend, in the homes of people that I'm staying with, Jim and Karen, the room that I do dokes on, and in their house is just filled with paintings on the wall done by Karen and friends of Karen. Bowls that must have been given to them by artists. All sorts of things in the room, and I just sit there and let it seep into me, all the vibes, and soothe my pain. Make my body easy. So I'm always looking for this when I enter a room. Look for the support, because my body doesn't have much energy and my lifestyle requires a great deal of energy. So I have to be part of any energy that's in the room. I'm the vampire. Chomping it up. So when I was doing body work many years ago, this can be taught. It can be taught to people, even people who aren't interested in Buddhism. I had a client. She was in a wheelchair, and she could stand for short periods of time, and then she'd collapse back into the wheelchair. So I was teaching her exercises that would strengthen her legs, so that she could spend more and more time out of the wheelchair. And so I gave her this tape of movements that would ease her pain and allow her to walk and stand. So I taught her a lot of different exercises that I did with her when I was with her, and then I told her, you do these while I'm not here till the next time I see you. So for a long time, she did her exercises just like taking medicine, just like most people who go to a physical therapist or a chiropractor or whatever do their exercises. Oh, God, it's time to do the exercises. I guess I have to do them. Blah, blah, blah. So she did it like that for a long time. Half-heartedly would be a kind word. So she didn't actually live through the exercises. I could tell by her questions. Well, how many times am I supposed to do this? So then one session, one time I came to her, to her house, and she greeted me right at the door with a big grin. And she said, with real delight in her voice, she said, I found out everything that happens to me is information about my body. She said, hurting or getting tired or exercising or not feeling like exercising, it's all information. And I saw that she had gone from mechanical movement into the timeless realm of sensation itself. She was inhabiting her life, her body. It was all, the whole universe was her medicine. To quote a koan about this, the whole universe was her medicine. And if you inhabit your life and do what's under your nose, brushing your teeth, taking care of your kids, you know, getting on the bus, getting on the freeway, if you do that wholeheartedly, all of those activities will be your medicine. So you can choose to take the body's point of view for a few hours a day, or a few days a week, or for 6 months, or for the rest of your life. You can choose to take the body's point of view. I encourage you to try it as an experiment. Decide you're going to spend 2 hours tomorrow from the body's point of view. Unfortunately, for most of us, if we do it for such a short time, we will tune into our bodies and find out that what it wants to do is sleep. That's usually short-term what bodies in our society right now want to do. You'd have to experiment with this over a longer period of time to hear, I want to play. I want to play. I want to go take a walk. I want to play tennis. I want to hear some other message besides I want to sleep. You would have to actually obey I want to sleep for a long time, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 solid days. Because most of us, one reason we don't tune into our body is what we find there is deep exhaustion. And so it's if we're going to continue to live like we live, it's important to get out of there right away and go back to our I have to go to work or get all this done mode. But actually, if you trust your body, you can go in and find deep exhaustion and still do the things you have to do. Exhaustion is not necessarily your enemy. It can just be what you feel like. Because those are two separate things. Feeling your body and then obeying it are two separate things. You should at least do some, though it's the first step. Feel it. And then make your decision over what's most important. Because just deciding that you have to do something that's counter to the needs of your body the price, if you pay the price of not even knowing what your body feels like, that's too high a price. And your body will not be your friend then. It will just be something you're disconnected from. So, you may actually find when you start to live your life from your body's point of view, you might find that thinking and decision making is actually easier. It's ironic that being in your body would then make intellection easier, but it's so. It's so. It's because you then have a stable point of view from which to assign priorities. So decision making is much easier when you live from the point of view of your body. When people feel settled in their bodies, they frequently experience a clarity and certainty that's very helpful in arranging priorities, the priorities of our ordinary lives. So doing a job from the point of view of your body requires some mental flexibility of going back and forth between intellection and body feeling. You can do the, actually, they can be pretty simultaneous when you get good at this. I think some of you have been in workshops with me in which I ask you to do a talking meditation. In other words, at the same time that you're talking or listening, tune into your breath. And at first, people have to tune out the other person or their own ideas. There's, when I ask them to describe a pleasurable event to the other person, people have to stop. They say, oh, well, we went sailing on the lake and and then we, you know, sailed out a little further and had a picnic. And at first it's clunky, but if you practice it for a while, then there's just breathing and talking. It's all together. So this is mental flexibility, being able to integrate different modes of your being. And this is extremely helpful because the different modes inform each other. There's all kinds of crisis situations where you think back later, you handled it badly, you think, and you think back later, oh, if only I'd thought of this or that. Well, if you're all present in the crisis situation, you have access to your deep resources. So that actually is, it's easier if you have access to your resources. So all the actual movements you make, reaching for the phone or settling into your chair, can be done with your mind focused on your body. These are good mindfulness practices. Some people use the phone, you know, as the beginning of mindfulness. You hear the phone ring. That means it's time to leave what you're doing and completely give yourself to the phone. Or every time you put your hand on a doorknob, you think of this. In fact, I think here it is. I brought a list of body practices. Let me see what time it is. Okay. So here's just a couple of them. Taking a regular rest period. So whenever you feel tired during the day, your practice is to take a rest. 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 seconds, whatever, that's up to you. But that's a body practice. That's honoring the body's need to have a timeout or some restoration. Another body practice is grooming mindfully. So most people, when they get up, they take a shower, brush their teeth, shave, get dressed. So that's a fairly long possibility of a fairly long period of meditation. how most people use that is to think of the day, is to order the day. But you can do that some other time. Actually having that time, from the time that you begin to groom yourself, maybe you've planned the day before you start to groom, then you're actually paying attention to how the toothbrush feels, how the shower feels, slipping cloth onto your skin, you know, running a brush through your hair. This is a very, very intimate practice. You're doing things to your body. Your body is responding. So this is a pretty good way, I think, to start the day. This is very important to me. I really enjoy my getting dressed and grooming myself. It's really comforting to me in some way. And then do a task mindfully. You know, vacuum mindfully, wash dishes mindfully. You've all heard this. Just pick out a task that you're always going to do mindfully. Folding laundry is a great one because it's a refuge from complexity. You know, that's just great to neaten things or to neaten a shelf or fold laundry, especially squares like or rectangles like pillowcases or dish towels or washcloths. It's so wonderful, the precision. Because it's so complex and chaotic, just folding rectangles is, oh, thank heaven. Something I can do. And then eating meditation, you have all heard of this and know what it is, to have some dish or some part of your meal every day that you eat mindfully and taste. And then you notice when you chew it and chew it until there's a reflex that causes you to swallow. And you chew it on this side, you chew it on this side, so on and so on. Then this communication meditation that I just mentioned, you know, this actually is very profound. People report to me after they start doing this meditation. Because if you include your breath in your communications with people, all your social habits get revealed to you. All your training, you know, all your beliefs that you have to do such and such in a social situation get exposed, and then you have a choice about whether to actually do them. And you also notice whether your social responses are actually appropriate. Sometimes they're not appropriate to do what we think we should do. It's not appropriate. For instance, if a person is telling you about their grief, you know, it's not appropriate to offer them advice. You know, just to witness their suffering is what's appropriate. But we ward off their suffering because we can't stand it. So just to settle into their pain is appropriate. Or we think that when we're listening to someone, we shouldn't include ourselves, like we shouldn't be paying attention to our breath. But actually, you find that you're much more, once you master this, being able to breathe and pay attention at the same time, pay attention to them and your breath at the same time, you find that bringing yourself, your breath, into a simple communication with a coworker is really a profound thing to do. Instead of just waiting till they're done so you can go do what you want to do, or waiting till they're finished so you can say what you want to say, it actually settles you into what they're saying as if you could stay there forever and receive them. Sometimes people are startled to get that much attention. Many people will meet you It's surprising to me how many people will meet you there and how many people it makes nervous. Oh my God, they're paying attention to me. I better start saying, making sense. You can see that go pass on people's face. And then chanting every day, you know, chanting one of these sutras that we chant every day, that's using breath and sound, and especially if it's nonsense syllables like Japanese is to us, then you don't have some attachment to the words. It's just a body practice, making sound in your throat. I myself do breath, you know, that kind of thing, continually, because it loosens. It's very healthy for me. I have chronic, you know, respiratory things, so it's very healthy for me to move things around, and it's also, it's like a feedback system. It vibrates things. And then being the classic posture, that's as old as Buddhism itself, the classic practice of noticing what posture you're in, the four postures, standing, lying, sitting, or walking. Just pick a couple times a day, 12 o'clock and 3 o'clock, and at those times, notice what posture you're in. That's really hard to do. But just trying to do it will start training your mind to be aware. And then my personal favorite is noting the awareness of nearby bodies. Only noticing it from the point of view of your own body. What I was mentioning Saturday, you can close your eyes and you know how many people are in this room. Because you feel them. They enter your torso. You can feel them. And they all have different feelings. So this practitioner I mentioned earlier who was in the gym, he also told me that he went to a sitting in his area. And he's a very handsome man, by the way. Handsome and privileged, comes from a wealthy family. So he said to me one time, he said, "Darlene, can I tell you something that I'm really ashamed of?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah." And he said, "I really judge people by how good looking they are." He said, "Well, you all do too, so I don't even have to tell you what he went on to say." And he said, "Since I've been sitting with this group where he lives now," he said, "I'm noticing that that's starting to fall away because I'm sitting with them. You know, I sit for days with them, and the feeling of their bodies has become more important than what they look like." He said, I can't tell you how happy I am to have that. So, you can let go of your preferences for a calm, clear zazen experience or relaxation and let your thinking come and go in your zazen. So, we can get very sensitive to these messages from our bodies, as he did. He suddenly fell into the world of body wisdom. And we can move these messages to the center of our consciousness rather than leaving them at the periphery or not noticing them at all. And through the course of our daily lives, we move anyway. So we might as well feel what it feels like to move while we're moving. We might as well learn to exploit this endless reminder that we're alive, we're pulsing with greed, hate, and delusion, with compassion, and with the wisdom of the ages. We're all vibrating with this all the time. So please settle into this wisdom and act from it forever. Thank you very much. Are there... should we do the chant after comments and questions or before? Seems like a fitting end to our time together. So are there any comments or questions?
You spoke tonight, as you have before, about how because of your condition you don't have a lot of natural inherent energy and you draw energy from your surroundings. I thought it was interesting tonight how you differentiated also between acknowledging your body's exhaustion and obeying your body's exhaustion. And I think I can understand how as a priest and as a teacher there are times when you can acknowledge it, but I can't obey it right now. I have things that I need to do. But I'm curious, what do you use as your guide for, okay, I've got to obey my body now. I can't make one more trip this week. I can't schedule one more dokusan today. Mm-hmm. I do need to, I need to recharge. How do you know that you're about to step beyond the appropriate threshold?
By whatever I want to do.
Can you explain a little bit more?
Well, if I can go on, I will. If my body asserts itself, I won't. So I may tune in and feel the exhaustion. Actually, my exhaustion is not a matter of tuning in for me. It's pretty omnipresent. When I get tired, I will feel tired. Mm-hmm. And so then it used to be that I was dropped from the heavens. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would be going someplace and that's it. Just cut out right there, no warning, no nothing. It was like that for many years, and I would just spend a lot of time in the back seat of a car waiting for, other people to take me home and go to bed. But it hasn't been like that for a long time. There's energy in the way the dust swirls. I always have a source of energy. So I don't abuse it. I always adjusting my life to reflect that. As I've gotten older, I've really adjusted my life accordingly. As I'm not coming for Monday nights anymore. Mm-hmm. It has to be a whole weekend. Mm-hmm. Because the trip up and back on one day is too much.
Sure.
But for a long time it was fine. So, thank you for that.
Thank you.
No, I don't defy my body. Mm-hmm. I just choose not to obey it sometimes. Anything else? By the way, I like your question very much because it's the kind of question that points to the middle way. If you can see your life as a series of questions, like Brian asked. So when you find yourself saying, it has to be this or this, they're both wrong. You always want to include everything. So Brian's question was, how do you include your body and your schedule? Your body and your greed, basically. For me, it's always greed. I always want to, I have to do this because I want to work with so-and-so. I have to do this because I'm going to see so-and-so. I have to do this to maintain my credentials as a Buddhist teacher. I have to do this to, So it's always greed for me. So how do I include greed and my body at the same time? So I make decisions that reflect that. So if you can include everything and not exclude, it's that in that poem, the jewel mirror ornament, turning away and touching are both wrong. In a relationship, you can't turn away from your mate, but you can't touch them. You can't be part of them, lean on them, take over their lives either. You have to do both at once. Stand and include them. You have to do both turning away and touching to have a successful relationship. So that was, I just wanted to point out that that was the way you framed the question was like that. Yes?
Last night you were talking about confusion. Maybe I misunderstood you, but you said underneath the thought there's confusion. Did I hear right? There was always a sense of confusion.
Well, that's because I'm a delusion type. I breed and hate types aren't nearly as confused as I am.
Yes. There is a sense, if I go to the feelings, there is a little confusion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember what you're talking about now. Yes. I was talking about why I thought people defer to authorities, to authority figures, rather than go with their own experience.
You think so? But I have that sense of, like, when I stop my mind and go to my feelings, there is always a little bit of, there's no solidity. It is a little bit of confusion. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what you're referring to.
I was.
Oh, okay.
So what a lot of people will do in that situation is give, because of that confusion, they won't respect what's here, the feelings, because there's a little, you know, squishiness. Mm-hmm. So then an authority figure comes along and says, blah, blah, and they, oh, right, that must be right. They abandon themselves and defer to the authority. But even though that may, you know, when you get deeper and deeper, the kind of thing I've been talking about, it's not exactly certainty, but it's good enough, it's close enough to certainty. The deeper you get your own kind of certainty, of course certainty is not trustworthy either, but you can, with the stability developed in Zazen, begin to trust the confusion as well. Like this fog that I go around in, it's pretty trustworthy. Mm-hmm. You know, I trust its inability to make decisions. And when decisions come bubbling up out of it, I go with that. Even though it's the best I can do then. And, you know, some of those decisions have to be apologized for. You know, some of those decisions have to be changed. You know, that kind of thing. But right there in that moment, I'm doing my best. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of negotiating for time so that decisions can be made deeper. Mm-hmm. I'm more comfortable with decisions that are made deeper, especially if they're consequential. I mean, what flavor ice cream I'm going to have is, it doesn't matter if I, you know, say, oh, chocolate. And then I think, oh, gee, that butterscotch looks good. I always have chocolate. I should have chosen the butterscotch. I don't really do that because I've got the chocolate. But decisions about the welfare of a student or someone I care about or something, I do want those to come deeper, and I'll just negotiate for time.
And you know that confusion is always there. It doesn't. I mean, it's always with you, in a sense, but you're comfortable with that.
It's there more often than not, but no, it's not always there. That's what I mean about going deeper. Right, and then it just kind of parts. Mm-hmm. It's like the sun shines mm-hmm. through. But for greed, for instance, people who have greed as a propensity, they don't have that so much. You know, I often envy people like that because they know just what they want, what they, you know, like like it appears, you know, like Dick Cheney is like that. It appears that way. You know, he always is very sure of himself, knows just what is good for himself and everything. So, you know, it's just a different thing to deal with. Sometimes it's not good to be so sure about something. You should look a little wider. You should get more confused, which is what a wide perspective does. It makes you a little more confused because there's more information. Yes.
One of the things that struck me while you were talking about your body and doing some of the practices, like there was one about that was more to the physical body when you're taking a shower, really paying attention to what you're doing at the moment. Really struck me as something that was like a yoga perspective of the body being a temple. And that you've kind of taken that on, that attitude on, that maybe that attitude wasn't there before, but that it's become more of a interaction with the body, or an attitude towards the body, of the body being mm-hmm. in some way sacred, in some way something that you don't take lightly. And that alters the interaction that you have with that aspect of you, meaning this body and mind together.
Mm-hmm. Your attention makes it a temple.
Yes.
You don't need the idea. You don't need to carry the idea around, though. My body is a temple. It's just while you're paying attention to it, it becomes clear that that's the case.
And I think if you do have that as a concept, it follows much more easily, the behavior follows much more easily, and the ability to then return to behaviors that treat your body as a temple.
Well, the only trouble with carrying that around as a concept, though, is it's a little distracting from actually being with your body.
Yes.
So it's safer to just pay attention to whatever you're paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And let that sacredness spring out of the moment of appreciation rather than some idea. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes.
I've noticed, and sometimes more than others, that I have a difficulty making decisions, lots of kinds of decisions. Like, one way I buy my time in a restaurant is I always ask to be the last one to choose something, so everybody else can go first. And so if I want to ask questions or something, then other people are so irritated. or when I'm talking to somebody, and like sometimes I'll just stop in mid sentence because another possibility will come to my mind. And while it looks confusing for other people, it really isn't confusing for me. But there is. And often there are other people to be around and to negotiate with and to make decisions with, etc. So that not looking at the big picture and just focusing on that little picture, like ice cream please, coffee please, you know, etc. It's just difficult. So I don't even know if I have a question, but that's what I've noticed.
So you're saying that you often focus on the big picture, so lots of things occur to you,
right.
Whereas, this is a matter of mental flexibility. Sometimes we want to focus on the big picture, and sometimes we want to focus on the detail.
Okay.
And that's it's a good idea to know which is appropriate.
Right.
in a particular situation, so that you're not always stuck in the big picture or always stuck in the small picture. My husband and I tend to be small picture people of really paying attention to this, you know. So, I mean, we slept on a bed that hurt us for years because we never occurred to us to get another bed. Because, well, now we're lying on the bed, now it hurts. So, you know, so I mean, when a person comes along who's a visionary and says, buy a new bed, we're so grateful.
You are Zen priest.
So it's good to have, to introduce some mental flexibility into your life. Now, my book, The One Who Is Not Busy, takes up this issue about focusing wide, which you should do at least a couple times a day, and then focusing in on the detail. Or depending on if you're doing a project at work that has a deadline, you need to come out and go in. Or you're even making a meal with a couple of courses. You've got to, and they all have to be done at the same time. That's big picture, but you've got to make each course. You've got to make it well and wholeheartedly. That's focusing in. And then you've got to come out again and see what to do next, and then go in again. So being able to change your... Well, I used to teach stress reduction to harried executives and other business professionals in a hospital. And they were all referred to my class by their doctors, you know, for different physical problems. And that's where that book came out of, because I was so impressed. This was during the dot-com boom. And what was the wrong, the basic problem that was wrong with everybody was they were stuck in one focus or another. And they couldn't negotiate come in and go out, come in and go out. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty important to develop that ability. And multitasking, what is multitasking but focusing on what you're not doing? That's why it's so unsatisfactory. But you can multitask. You just need to focus on what you are doing and then quickly focus on and sink in for a couple of seconds to the next thing you're doing, and then sink in, taking a sip of coffee, emailing, talking on the phone, whatever. It takes a lot of mental flexibility to multitask in a way that's emotionally satisfying. But it's fun, you know, if you're a meditator, it's kind of a test.
I want to just mention a place where this was not an issue at all. It's when I recently with my family members, went to Cape Verde, Africa, and it's a third world country. So everything is a new task. You don't brush off the crumbs the same way because there are animals that will come pick them up. You don't go to the bathroom the same way. You don't bathe the same way. You don't get to go to the store the same way. You don't do the kitchen the same way. None of the things are regular tasks are the same. And so they all, you know, you have to have this, you know, this deep concentration that is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then you can just, you're just able to focus in on it, and then this is the next thing, and it's all new. It's like being a kid again. Mm-hmm. And so the decisions have to come very quickly. You know, I mean, you don't think about growing up when, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to make this piece of fruit that you've never seen before. So, very immediate.
Right. So if you have mental flexibility, it's good to come out, think of world peace and how that influences what you're doing right this minute, or how what you're doing right this minute influences, you know, ecology or world peace or whatever, and go back to this holy thing. Thank you so much. It's been a wild ride these 3 days.